Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic-butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Ruler is the world's finest magazine of cycling and cycling culture. Established in 2006, Ruler interviews the world's biggest cycling names and covers the world's biggest cycling races. Visit our website at ruler.cc and subscribe to support our in-depth features, long reads, independent journalism, stunning photography and immersive cycling coverage. I'm Edward Pickering, I'm the editor of Ruler, and this is Ruler Conversations. We've got a two-part podcast for you today. In the main part, I'm going to be interviewing Peter Flax. Peter is a sometime cycling journalist. He's worked in a variety of fields, including running journalism and as editor-in-chief of The Hollywood Reporter. But cycling has been a constant thread in his life, and he's written an excellent book about what cycling means to him and how it enhances and affirms life itself. The book is called Live to Ride, Finding Joy and Meaning on a Bicycle, which I think we all do a lot. And you can hear my interview with Peter in the second part of the pod. But first, we couldn't let the weekend of racing pass without comment, and I'm joined by Rachel Jarry, Ruler's staff writer. We're going to discuss Milan-San Remo and Trofeo Alfredo Binder, won by Jasper Philipsen and Elisa Balsamo, respectively. So Rachel, you're between trips to the UAE Tour and Belgium for the upcoming Classics. Must have been nice to watch the races at home for once.
It was nice. I almost think when you're watching at home, you get to see more of the race than you do when you're there in person. So in terms of looking at tactics and stuff, it's definitely easier to watch at home. You do miss that buzz of the finish, though, and speaking to all the riders and seeing all the emotion as soon as they cross the line. But yeah, I think for San Remo, especially because that finale is so tactical, it's one that is good to watch at home and then be able to kind of skip back and work out what really happened. Because I don't know about you, but when I was watching that last 20K, I was so like excited and exhilarated by the finish that I almost forgot to actually look at what was happening. It's like all the emotion happens so quickly in that race that it's hard to really process the tactics.
Let's talk about that final part of the race. Philipsen was the winner, but you know, the race was defined more in my mind by a single rider, Tadej Pogačar, who was dominating headlines before, during and after the race.
Really, his team did what everyone expected by trying to make things hard earlier on in the race and trying to drop some of those sprinters, but they didn't quite manage to execute that plan. They rode hard on the Cipressa, which I think a lot of people thought they were going to, and they definitely strung out the peloton, but it didn't really have the desired impact of dropping your Philipsens and riders like that. And I think you could see Pogačar was on the radio for a lot of the time trying to get more riders to the front to try and drop more and more riders, but it didn't quite work. I don't really know if you can blame that on the strength of his teammates or if you just have to look at the parkours of San Remo and come to the conclusion that maybe it's just not hard enough.
There's a lot of talk about the Cipressa before the race. Some people talk about Pogačar actually attacking on the Cipressa. I don't know if that's really a wise thing to do, just unless the previous part of the race had been ridden very differently. But my read on it was that the intention was for UAE Emirates to reduce the fields to 15 or 20 or so few riders that no one would have teammates to do work afterwards, and then he could deal with everyone on the Poggio. But it just didn't work out. And you think maybe that was because the Cipressa is not hard enough?
I think so. I also think it's not long enough, maybe more than hard enough. I think there's those flat roads in between the Cipressa and the Poggio give too many riders a chance to get back on the front. I also think there's something to be said for the fact that sprinters in the modern peloton are becoming a lot stronger and they're becoming all-rounders. When you see how the peloton's racing Tour de France stages now so aggressively. The sprinters have kind of been forced to evolve a little bit and be able to get through really like short, steep climbs. And the likes of Jasper Philipsen and Michael Matthews, Mads Pedersen are all versatile enough now to get over a climb like the Chipressa. It's not as simple as, okay, let's drop these heavy sprinters, because a lot of them can also win races like the Tour of Flanders, and then they're becoming more versatile. That's another reason why it didn't quite play off. I remember reading an article before the race, one of the UAE sports directors saying that he thought the Chipressa needed to be completed in under 9 minutes for the race to be hard enough to drop the sprinters and to string it out. And I think that they did it in 9:34. So they were a lot slower than the pace that I think Pogacar would have needed to drop his rivals.
I kind of think the idea was not necessarily a bad one, but they didn't have the combination of circumstance and manpower to actually make it happen, because they lost position before the Chipressa, and it takes time to work yourself back into positions. I also think that if they had continued riding over the top, maybe they could have stopped other riders from catching up. It's so easy to say, isn't it? In the end, maybe if they had had a team with the strength in depth on that kind of train of Visma Lisa bike, maybe they could have broken the field up and broken it up permanently. They just, for whatever reason, they just couldn't do it, and that meant the strategy was ultimately going to fail.
I think realistically, for that strategy to work, they needed to drop like the riders who eventually finished top 10, right? Which it is a really hard thing to do. I think this is where Pogacar's aim of winning all five monuments, I really worry that San Remo is the one that's going to elude him forever, because I just don't think it's hard enough for him to make the difference. I mean, it's not really a race I see being won on like pure strength and pure physical ability. There's so many other factors involved. We saw that with how Jasper Philipsen won. Like, he probably wasn't the strongest rider in the race, but he still won because of how he rode it and because of the dynamics of that group at the end, with him having Van der Poel there as a teammate. Pogacar was almost certainly the strongest rider there, but San Remo isn't won by being the strongest.
You were confident enough in that belief that you wrote a piece on Ruler.cc about it as well. So it's quite brave to say that he'll never win Milan-San Remo. But after he's been in top five 3 times now, he must be wondering what he has to do to win this race. Like, can he make just one more bit of difference? Should he maybe sit back a bit? I don't know. I mean, it's hard to say what he can do differently to win the race. And it's true that he made the weather for the entire race, and even with all his ability and strength, and I think I agree with you, he was the strongest, he couldn't quite close the deal.
I'm not quite sure what he can do differently to make San Remo a better race for him. I'll probably be wrong, and in next year he'll win, and I'll feel really stupid for saying this, but that's just my thinking after watching this year's race.
I can't remember what's on the web last week, Rachel, let alone last year. There was just one more optimistic note for Pogacar before we get on to the actual winner of the race. I think if Mathieu van der Poel had not been in this race, he could have won. It was van der Poel who tracked Pogacar's first attack, which pretty much broke up what was left of the peloton, and van der Poel was able to just stay close enough on his second attack that he formed a bridge between the riders behind who had been dropped and Pogacar. Maybe there's one year, when there is not that rider who's almost as strong and as gifted as Pogacar and can make that difference. And of course, van der Poel also closed down everything on the descent and into San Remo as well. I think he has what it takes to win it. It's just, I think the circumstances and the luck also has to be on his side.
Van der Poel was probably the most crucial person to deciding the eventual results of this race. He even closed down Tom Pidcock's attack in that closing kilometre. Whether Pidcock would have been brought back if he didn't do that, I don't know. What more do you want than having Van der Poel as a teammate if you're Jasper Philipsen? And Philipsen had no excuse not to finish it off in the sprint, really.
Yeah, absolutely. So Philipsen, the winner. I can't believe that the other riders in that race allowed the race to come down to a sprint between him and them, because I think once he made it over the Poggio, he was just always going to win. He's so much faster than the other riders there that he was a a logical winner.
He is faster, but then again, it was pretty close between him and Michael Matthews. Michael Matthews did a really good sprint. It was like less than half a wheel, I think, between them. So it wasn't like Philipsen completely wiped the floor with the rest of that group. The finish was pretty close. Jasse Philipsen is incredible rider, and I think he's becoming a real all-rounder. Like we're talking about, he's not just a sprinter who is very, very fast, but he's also performed really well at Paris-Roubaix. Now he's won San Remo. He's really versatile, and yeah, it was you can't really fault how he rode it.
Van der Poel and Philipsen, it's a formidable pairing, isn't it, when you think about their assets, and also the fact that they do seem to function very well together. They seem to be very happy to ride for each other. They've got one of the absolute best sprinters in the world combined with one of the absolute best classics riders in the world who work harmoniously together.
Which is quite a rare thing as well. I think when you've got two riders who are so good with such big ambitions, who both know that they're going into San Remo with a chance to win, the fact that they can make that teamwork dynamic function successfully is quite impressive. And we saw it in the Tour de France as well, when Van der Poel was leading out Philipsen for some of the sprint stages. They do seem to have a really good bond. Credit to the team, I suppose, for managing those two egos, because you know, it must be quite hard when you're going into a race like San Remo to decide who to go for. Van der Poel, you know, he's the world champion. He could pull rank, but I think it says a lot about him as a rider and about his character that he is prepared to sacrifice his race there, knowing that Philipsen had a better chance in the sprint.
Yeah, and there were attacks off the descent and into San Remo. And you know, Milan-San Remo can be won with these stealth attacks. When Jasper Stuyven won a couple of years back, he just attacked off the descent. And it's not so much that it was a great attack, it was, but also it's the hesitation behind that defines that. This time, Matej Mohoric had a go just before they came off the descent. And in another year, maybe he would have got a gap and the group behind would have started looking at each other. But same with Matteo Sobrero's attack, same with Tom Pidcock's attack, which looked pretty good. Each time on this occasion, there was no hesitation, basically because Van der Poel, at some point between the top of the Poggio and the finish, he morphed from ambitious individual rider who could look at winning it himself to teammate of Jasper Philipsen.
Yeah, I mean, Mohoric's attack, when he originally made that move, I actually thought that could be it. But it's also worth bearing in mind that Trek had two riders in there, because they had Mads Pedersen and Jasper Stuyven. So that's another team with numbers who have an incentive to chase lone breakaway riders. So I suppose that makes a difference as well for Pidcock and Mohoric and Vettiol, who were isolated in that group. It's going to be pretty hard to control things.
You mentioned Lidl Trek as well, who probably could come away from this a little bit disappointed, because they had a similar pairing to Alpecin De Koninck. They had Stuyven, who's been a decent sprinter in the past, but he's very much a kind of attacker and classics rider, and then Mads Pedersen, who can win big sprints and is very fast, but just came up pretty short in the end. I was a little bit underwhelmed by the fact they didn't make it to the podium.
I think someone like Mads Pedersen, he said it plenty of times that he needs a hard race to be able to sprint against somebody like Philipsen. He needs things to be a bit more attritional, and it's hard for like me to compute, but they averaged something crazy like 46 kilometers an hour over the whole race. But Pogacar did say that it was very easy. You can't really tell because he's like superhuman, so his version of easy might be different to everyone else's. But if the race was easier than maybe people expected, for someone like Pedersen, that's just not really going to suit. He needs a sprint where the others are a bit tired and have had to work a bit harder, whereas by the sounds of it, the race wasn't ridden hard enough for someone like Philipsen to be tired out enough. He still had all that top end speed.
Regrets for many riders, hindsight for all of us, and we'll look forward to seeing if Tadej Pogacar can finally unlock the puzzle next year. But that's Milan-San Remo. Let's talk Trofeo Alfredo Binder. And I was out of commission on Sunday, so you're going to have to take the lead on this race. So what happened in the race, and why did Elisa Balsamo win?
Well, it was a really interesting race. It was really aggressive. There were a lot of attacks. I think pre-race, everyone was talking about the fact that Lotte Kopecky had been substituted in for SD Works because Chantal Vandenbroek Black was unable to start. So that when you have the world champion in your team, obviously that automatically means everyone's watching you. There's been this narrative throughout the last kind of two seasons about SD Works being so dominant, and the question marks were over whether they could sustain it in this race, a race that Lidl Trek have historically been very successful in. They've won the last four editions now, I think. They were kind of the two super teams that people were watching. And yeah, the race, it played out interestingly. There were moments where I thought teams might be trying to attack, but riders like Niamh Fisher-Black really strung things out on the final climb. Puck Peterse of Phoenix de Kooninck was another really aggressive rider, but in the end, they just couldn't split things, and it came down to a reduced bunch sprint, which Elise Bassmer was just quite plainly the fastest by quite a long way as well. I don't know what that means, but Capecchi has been quite vocal about losing weight for this season and improving her climbing technique with a view of the Tour de France later in the year. So whether that means she sacrificed a little bit of her top end speed, maybe, because she looked stronger than Bassmer on the climbs, but when it came to the finish, Balsamo's turn of speed was like, Capecchi was nowhere near matching that. So it was good to see Lidl Trek quash the dominance of SD Works, and they rode like a pretty much perfect race, fully backed Elisa Balsamo for the win, whereas SD Works seemed to go for a bit more of a scattergun approach. Like Niamh Fisher-Black was trying attacks, Marlon Rusa was trying attacks for SD Works, whereas Lidl Trek were completely backed Elisa Balsamo, and that strategy paid off in the end.
Yeah, and Balsamo's good at those 40-50 rider sprints. The first time I ever saw her actually was when I was at the Tour of California in 2019, and the final stage of the women's race, which I think was called the Amgen Tour of California Women's Race Empowered with SRAM. Final stage, you know, Pasadena's traditionally a sprint, I think, but they stuck a big mountain in that stage. There was a 9 or 10K climb. That meant that I think some of the faster sprinters didn't make it to the finish, and she won the bunch sprint. I remember being quite struck by how easily she won that. Obviously, she's a former world champion as well. So, you know, when it comes to smaller group sprints at the end of hard races, she's actually quite a logical favourite, isn't she?
Yeah, exactly. Like, we saw her win in Flanders, win the world championships, which was a pretty rolling, punchy course, and she doesn't seem to struggle to get over the shorter climbs, and she's won Trofeo Binder before, so she knows she can handle those sorts of climbs. It's quite common in the women's peloton really to see it. You rarely get like a full-on bunch sprinter because there isn't that many opportunities for them throughout the season, so it's quite common to see riders like Balsamo who can get over some of the shorter climbs. But also, we should definitely give credit to her teammates as well. Like Shirin Van Anroy was really crucial to making sure that it came down to a bunch sprint. She was so strong and chased down every attack, and like they worked so well together as a team, and I don't think Balsamo could have done it without them. She was really gritting her teeth and hanging on some of those final climbs, but yeah, she managed to do it.
What's next for you, Rachel?
I'm going to the Tour of Flanders in 2 weeks, and then Paris-Roubaix after that. So always two really good races to cover as a journalist, especially Roubaix, when you can be in the velodrome at the finish, seeing everyone claps covered in mud and blood usually, and you get those reactions straight away. So yeah, I'm excited for that.
Very envious of you being there. So thanks to Rachel for joining us. Just a reminder that listeners to Rouleur Conversations can get 15% off the price of a regular subscription by subscribing at rouleur.cc/subscribe and entering the code podcast15. Next up, I'm going to be speaking with Peter Flax about his new book, Live to Ride, Finding Joy and Meaning on a Bicycle. I'm interrupting this podcast to remind all listeners to subscribe to Rouleur, the world's finest magazine of cycling and cycling culture. Our latest edition, out now, is Rouleur 125, Cycling Will Change the World. We're celebrating cycling's ability to make the world a much better place in this edition of Rouleur, with a set of features looking at active travel. Cycling is about the closest thing to a silver bullet that policymakers around the world have to improve life. It reduces pollution, makes people healthier, reduces congestion, makes people richer, makes the roads safer, and generally makes our towns and cities better places to live. There are also exclusive interviews with Primoz Roglic and Elisa Longo-Borghini. And we also spent a day on the farm with Guillaume Martin, who is not only a World Tour cyclist, but also won a major literary award in France. Rouleur is the world's finest magazine of cycling and cycling culture, and Rouleur 125 is available now. To support our journalism and receive a magazine every 6 weeks, please subscribe. Go to rouleur.cc, hit the subscribe button, and enter the code podcast15 to get 15% off our regular subscription price. And now, back to the show. So we have a special guest on Ruler Conversations this week. I'd like to welcome and introduce Peter Flax, sometime cycling journalist. You've been a showbiz reporter. I was particularly excited as a secret runner that you've been a running journalist as well. So to the listeners of Ruler Conversations, Peter is the former editor-in-chief of Bicycling Magazine, has worked for Runner's World and The Hollywood Reporter, and his new book, Live to Ride, Finding Joy and Meaning on a Bicycle, is out this week. Peter, welcome to Ruler Conversations.
Really great to be here. I've been a long time admirer of the Ruler brand and so happy to be here.
Where are you at the moment? It looks a bit sunnier and lighter than it is here in the UK.
Yeah, I live in a small town called Manhattan Beach, which is in Los Angeles County, maybe a kilometer from the ocean.
And before we dive into the book, I'd like to know a bit more about you. I've read your stuff for years, but our British listeners especially might not know you so well. So can you give us a brief curriculum vitae of how you got into journalism?
Well, I've been writing and editing for 30 years now. I've worked at maybe 10 magazines and edited a lot of different kinds of magazines, as you mentioned, like running. I worked at a hiking and outdoors magazine. I've worked at The Hollywood Reporter. But in terms of my real passion, writing has always been my passion. And so early on, I just tried to do writing on the side about bike racing. And over time, it has really broadened where at this point, I think I've written about almost every aspect of riding culture, a lot of advocacy, a lot of just the ways in which riding culture intersects with all the other important issues in life. For me, the journey in the space has been a long road.
What's your background in cycling?
I guess I would say that I'm an enthusiast. I did race for 10 or 15 years, and it's really hard to overstate how bad I was at it. But I did have a phase where I really, did one or two races a week for the warm months and was never more than pack fodder. But I've been a bike tour. I've been a commuter. At this point on my journey, I've done, I think, every kind of riding. Right now in Los Angeles, most of my riding is what I'd call utility riding. I have about a 15-mile commute to my office. And so, right now I get like 150 miles a week just going to and from work in LA, which is maybe a little bit more exciting than I wish it was. Yeah, so I think a lot of people who ride for most of their lives, they go through phases of like what kind of riding they do and what they love about it. I'm at a point now where I realize that I've loved every step along the way, even just being like the guy who finishes 50th in races. I loved every piece of the journey.
And how did you discover cycling?
I grew up in the New York suburbs, and in the 70s, when I was a kid, everybody just biked to school. And it was really like a leafy suburban setting. And when I was, I think, still in elementary school, my parents bought me like a 10-speed Fuji with drop bars and Suntour components. And then soon thereafter, we would go on summer trips that were riding focused. So I've been riding since I was a kid. Like it didn't strike me as a sport or even a hobby till later on, but I spent a lot of time just being on a bike and feeling this sense that when I was pedaling that there was something beautiful about it.
That comes from the book, actually. That's probably what the book is about, actually, isn't it? You've called it Live to Ride. Why did you write the book? What was your motivation in getting this out there?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think in a lot of ways it started when I moved to Los Angeles. As you mentioned, I had been the editor-in-chief of Bicycling, and at the end of my tenure there, I got fired in just sort of corporate BS, and I moved here and I got a job at The Hollywood Reporter, which obviously has almost nothing to do with bikes, although I did, get some bike stories in there. And I stopped being like this fitness enthusiast with this huge platform. And so I really had to like rethink what my role in bike culture was and what it meant to me. And I think the combination of those things and becoming this hardcore transit rider, which was new to me, made me realize how much I loved it and how all this different kind of riding I'd done and the different riders I'd met were all more interconnected. And I saw just this history of subcultures in riding where everybody just felt like only the people that did the kind of riding they do or wear the same kind of kit that they do are connected, right? Like I remember just like relentlessly making fun of triathletes or people that had mirrors on their helmets and just like over time came to realize that we all have way more in common than we realize and that for the culture to be what we want it to be, folks need to come together.
You've expressed actually what the book is about, haven't you? The you've divided the book into sections. The sections are adventure, speed, utility, nature, competition, and self-expression. And it made me think about my own relationship with cycling, that when I ask myself what it is to be a cyclist, I would have had a much more definite answer 10 or 15 years ago than I do now. It's much more complex now. I used to be much more of a racer. I would basically be in it for racing, but I've always loved seeing different landscapes and going to different places. I've always found it a very useful tool from getting to A to B. And I've realised that when you're a cyclist, it's very hard to define yourself as anyone thinks. It's a very fluid definition. And as you say, there's lots of intersections between all these different ways of cycling.
I've been married for more than 20 years. And in some ways, you realise that the relationship with riding is like a marriage, and if you try and define it in really simplistic terms, it falls apart after a while. And the relationship is complicated, and it evolves, and you reassess your perspectives all the time. And I think that people who've been riding for decades totally understand what I mean, and people who don't ride are like, what, how is a bike like a marriage? I think part of what will define like who the audience is, that there are probably some small number of millions of people who ride enough to understand that, and then tens or hundreds of millions of people who have no idea what I'm talking about.
And I thought it'd be cool to actually divide up the interview into the same sections as you've divided the book into, and we can look at each of these on their own and then probably work out at the end that a little bit of this applies to all of us. So the first section, adventure, and it's a good one to start with because it seemed to be linked to a very formative moment in your own relationship with cycling when you cycled across the United States of America. So tell us about that journey and tell us about what you mean when you're talking about adventure on a bike.
In 1992, I rode from Seattle to New York, and it surely is the greatest adventure of my life. I did it with just my best childhood friend. It was as free of an adventure as I ever had. We would just wake up every day with no idea where we were winding up, and I was a young man and able to be in the moment. And there was, you know, we went through these famous national parks in the West, and we rode across the plains and slept in town parks. And I guess the piece that sticks with me now is just realizing, you know, my life as a middle-aged husband and father and editor-in-chief is, I have so many more obligations, and that kind of adventure isn't in the cards right now, but realizing that there are like small threads of that kind of adventure that mean a lot to me and that I can still access. Like lately in the last year or two, I've been doing a lot of these rides here in Los Angeles where I look at like train schedules and I get up in the morning and I just ride to this faraway train station to take a train home, where just the idea of pedaling for 3 or 4 hours to get to some part of California that I haven't ridden on the roads before means a lot. And just like getting a little lost in a strange place and feeling like that there's more to the experience than just like, it's more than a workout, it's more than a utilitarian journey to a store. It's like that feeling of just being out there and discovering things. And I think almost everyone who rides on some level feels that, even if you're just commuting, to be like, oh, I'm going to take a right and take this back road instead of the normal route, that feeling of just mixing it up or just seeing things that are like, if you ride in a city, you just constantly have like little moments where something weird happens and it makes you feel alive. And so I think that's kind of the theme of adventure, and that in bike culture now, I think you see with like bike packing and gravel riding coming to be more mainstream, that there are more people that are taking like explicit steps to find that adventure. Like, yeah. I see it within the culture.
Riding across the States it's a pretty epic adventure. Some big gravel rides are huge expeditions. We sometimes associate adventure with the idea of a very big journey. But what you've also drilled into in the book is the fact that you can also have an adventure on a micro level. It's not just the macro level. You can have an adventure on a short ride, on every ride, in fact.
Yeah, I have like bittersweet memories about my tenure at the Hollywood Reporter, but part of that was that we had really late deadlines on a weekly basis. And so twice a week, I would ride home at like 1 a.m. in Los Angeles. And just the experience of being in one of the world's biggest cities and riding on quiet streets in the middle of the night, you know, seeing coyotes run around LA, or just the way the city transforms that in like a 50 or 60 minute ride could just feel like you had done a real adventure and felt something sustaining in that, where you don't have to ride 2,500 miles or go into the backcountry to experience that.
And I guess there's an urge to explore in every cyclist. I think it's one of the things about owning a bike and cycling on it is that you give yourself the capacity to go and explore, and that's a human instinct.
Yeah, that's totally true. And I think for most people, it circles back to childhood and adolescence. That I remember when I got my first road bike, and realizing that the territory I could explore just around where I grew up had just massively expanded, and you had this chance to like go to a neighborhood you'd never been to on your own, or go to the next town, or follow this path along the river and see where it goes. And the, you know, this freedom that a lot of people get a taste of on a bike when they're young, before they can drive. And for a lot of passionate riders, that feeling just never goes away. Like I definitely can like access this thing that feels like childhood joy in being able to explore on a bicycle.
And then the next theme that you've explored is speed. And that appeals to a different part of the human psyche maybe than adventure and exploration. And I enjoy this chapter because I think it most closely correlated with what I think is exhilarating about cycling. That's that feeling of fast movement. It's faster than humans were really designed to go, and that has its own exhilaration.
Yeah, the idea of speed is really fascinating to me, and it's really, you know, like as you'll note, like competition is a separate idea and a separate chapter, and so when I'm talking about speed, I'm not talking really necessarily about racing, but that visceral feeling that you get on a bike. And again, it goes back to anyone who was a kid and had that feeling of like going down a hill and realizing that the bike could handle it. You know, I ride around LA a ton now, and I always am seeing super casual cyclists that are clearly feeling that sense that they're, you know, on a beach path going down a tiny little hill, and they put their feet out off the pedals, or just that feeling of knowing that you can do 20 hard pedal strokes to get through a light before it turns red, right? There are all these things that are really pleasing about riding a bike and feeling like the physics of going fast.
You've explored an area which it's quite new in cycling, I guess, that you can get that sensation on an e-bike as well, and it's becoming quite it's opening up that experience to, well, everybody.
One of the more interesting conversations in the book, I interviewed about 30 personalities in cycling culture to talk to them about one of these themes. And I did have a conversation with Greg LeMond about speed. And, you know, he's an individual who obviously was pretty damn good at going fast on his own, but because of health realities he's dealing with right now, he is really tuned into the e-bike world and this idea of like bringing that euphoric feeling of speed to a much larger group of people. And so, yeah, I do think that feeling of like if you've ridden in a race or done that kind of higher level road racing, riding, that you know that feeling of going fast. And e-bikes like give people a taste of that, which is at all not, I don't think, a bad thing. Obviously, we want people to be safe, but it you know, for people to see what it's like to go 20 miles an hour and the way that a well-engineered bike moves, those are good things as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, and I think it may be why, from my perspective, I find cycling very addictive, because that feeling is totally free. It has no downside as far as I can see. It's like a drug with none of the downsides.
Yeah, it is definitely. I mean, I think there are a bunch of these ideas that we're talking about that are like a drug one way or another. But this is for sure. There's definitely a biochemistry to the feeling of like feeling good as you're moving on a bike at speed that is narcotic. Yeah. And I feel it. And right. Like there's this feeling of like, oh, you're tired, I don't feel like going hard, and then you pick up some speed and suddenly the energy is there and it's a beautiful thing. Like I stopped drinking a couple years ago and now I'm at a point where I'm really careful about what I eat, and so maybe like a disproportionate amount of whatever addictive energy I have goes into the riding, and it feels like as good an addictive feeling as you can have, right? But it's narcotic, and people who ride a lot know that.
Yeah, and there's a feeling which is hard to define, but it happens maybe two or three times a year. You get a great day, maybe, you know, maybe the tarmac is smooth, the wind is behind you, but even more than that, it feels like you're flying. You are just going well, everything's in harmony, it feels fast, and you feel like you are at one with the speed.
Yeah, you're probably a better rider than I am. I like am happy if I get like an hour like that on it. I don't even think about like as a day, that if I have like a stretch where everything just feels beautiful and right, it you know, part of it is like you feel your body doing this thing that it was meant to do, right? Like we live in a culture where a lot of us spend all day like at a desk and you have all these obligations, and you know, now people like go to a gym and they ride like on a bike at a gym, and it's like so that this feeling of being outside and your body moving, and when you get that feeling that everything's in sync and you feel the wind and the weather, it's just a beautiful thing.
The next theme you've explored in the book is very different one actually, but at the same time very linked. Utility, and it's something I've become very interested in the last 3 or 4 years. The latest edition of Rudo, we had a section on active travel, and the magazine was entitled Cycling Will Save the World. Bikes are about the best, cheapest, healthiest, least environmentally impactful way, fastest way of getting around urban environments, and you've explored that.
It's really hard to define exactly what a bicycle is, because you can have part of your riding life where it feels like a piece of fitness equipment, and it can feel like a toy, and it can feel like a way to, you know, just do all these pleasurable things. But it's also like an incredible object of transportation. And I see that within bike culture really changing. I think the most obvious place to go is just to like a really good coffee shop and just see all manner of bicycles of all, you know, like $10,000 racing bikes and beach cruisers and everything in between, that people in urban areas in particular have discovered just how a bike is often like a better and more pleasurable way to get to places they want to be than a car. I know here in LA, you know, I've been here 10 years now, and I have used a bicycle as my primary way to get around. And a lot of times people talk to me like, you know, how do I do it? And, you know, how brave or hardy it must be. But it's like, from my point of view, I feel so fortunate that it just, because it's so much fun and it's actually so effective. Like, from where I live to my office, to ride on a bike, I can do it in 55 minutes. And if I pulled up a map app, it would take me probably 50 to drive it. It's like, and then I get to work and I take a shower and I've had this adventure and exercise. It's like an incredibly effective tool in urban and suburban places to get around. And there are these huge pockets of people who ride who they don't think they have anything in common with, like, the spandex wearing enthusiast, but they ride a ton and they feel a lot of the same affinity to the experience of riding that everybody else does. And so the experience of moving here and becoming a transit rider, like, affected me deeply, of just realizing how it's not that dissimilar from other kinds of riding.
Yeah. And Los Angeles is more famous for cars, maybe traffic jams, 7-lane highways, etc. So are you unusual in Los Angeles, or are there a fair number of people commuting by bike these days?
I know other people that commute, and I am extremely lucky. Like, the first half of my commute is on this really beautiful multi-use path that is on the beach along the Pacific Ocean. And so when I ride in the morning, I see dozens of other commuters heading in both directions. But it's so far from like a de facto way to get around, particularly if your commute is more than a few miles. But it you know, the weather here is extremely attractive. Like, you know, people complain because we get a couple months of rain in the winter, but it's never freezing here. It's pretty easy to ride year-round. But it is hard to express to people who haven't ridden here. Like, I grew up in the New York area, and so, like, the big, dense eastern cities are pretty complicated places to ride. But, like, L.A., there are roads here that are simply not rideable. I still, even now, as a really experienced rider, have moments where I wind up jumping on the sidewalk, what I guess you guys would call the pavement, pretty often, because you just get into an environment where it is not safe to ride. And I think that's why here in California, you've seen a lot of even like pro racers get involved in advocacy, because no matter what kind of rider you are, you're connected by the sense of how unnecessarily dangerous it can be to ride. And that, and so, like, that is this really unifying thread for almost everyone who rides, is just sort of realizing how unnecessarily risky it can feel if you're in the wrong place.
And could you ever see the USA moving towards a situation like there in the Netherlands or Denmark, where, you know, they've got 30-50% of journeys in cities on bikes? Or would that be a bit optimistic?
I think there's going to be massive change. It's already happening. As an American rider, it just feels just so endlessly frustrating about how slow it's happening. And there's just so much of an embedded car dependence in how our cities and communities were built. And, you know, so many decades and trillions of dollars have gone in to make our streets and cities the way they are. And so, yeah, you see changes happening all the time. There was just a piece of like a proposition put in front of voters in Los Angeles to make roads safer for pedestrians and riders, and it passed by a very wide margin, which means that you know, many tens of thousands of Angelenos voted for something even if they don't ride. And so there's all sorts of hopeful developments happening, but I'm afraid it's going to take like decades for it to look the way a lot of riders wish it looked. There's just because people want it to stay the way they are, and they just are like, you know, getting to my job or my school already takes a long time. I don't want, like, don't mess with the streetscape to somehow make it take longer to get where I want to go.
One of the benefits you mentioned in the book is just that when you cycle to your place of work, you are not separated from the environment that you cycle through. Whereas I always feel in a car, it is a cocoon. You're locked away from it, and it's a very different experience. And it's actually a very beneficial one, I think.
Realistically, a lot of people might just like listen to a podcast like this when they're in their car driving to work. You can have this experience where you're like in this climate controlled thing with like a great audio system and a comfortable seat. And so you sort of like leave reality for some period of time and you're in this comfortable machine. And when I ride to work, it's always like, you know, I know which way the wind is blowing, and I never wear any earpieces or headphones of any kind. So it's like, you know, you just like, especially in a place like LA, you hear the city, you smell the city, you feel it, and you've had like an experience where instead of like looking out a window, you're just part of the, you're not watching the movie, you're in the movie. And the people who ride a lot feel that and feel there's something wonderful about being a part of it.
And you alluded to the difference between the spandex-clad serious cyclists, the racers, etc., and regular people on bikes. And it's something that's kind of popped up a few times recently in the discourse about cycling in the UK, is that in the Netherlands, there are different words for cyclist. There is fietser for just a person on a bike who's getting from A to B, and then a wheelrenner for somebody who is trying to do so very fast. That difference helps kind of, it not only describes it, but it conceptualizes the difference between the two. But at the same time, cyclists are cyclists also.
One little mantra I've been saying on Twitter for X for a long time is like, if you're riding a bike, you're doing it right. And this feeling for everybody that you know, not to see someone going faster or slower or wearing like different fabric than you and thinking that you're apart from each other. It's like you just look at the universe. We have so much more in common. And I have days where I wear like the equivalent of what I'd call like Giro New Road stuff, where I've got like non-technical looking clothes, but maybe, you know, chamois and spandex underneath or something wicking. And it just does not matter. It's like I'm the same person, whatever shape my handlebar is or what shirt I'm wearing.
So the fourth theme you've explored is nature. And from a personal point of view, I think more than any of the other attractions for cycling, this is the one that most deeply spoke to me. And I think this is my primary reason for cycling, is that I find cycling to be a sensory and educational experience. And you've talked about nature as in, you know, cyclists are out there in the landscape, exploring that landscape, absorbing the sights and sounds and beauty and sometimes ugliness and everything around them. And for me, that's the most visceral attraction for cycling. So what were you getting at when you talk about nature?
Yeah, I think, again, this is one that people who ride intuitively know, this feeling of like just being connected to a landscape, being connected to the weather, being connected to plants and the sky and the ocean and the mountains and the trees. There's just so many moments. I at this point I've ridden all over the US and quite a bit in Europe, and there's just like thousands of moments where you're on a ride and you just like sense this feeling of being a part of something beautiful. You know, it could just be like going through a small stretch of like forest or cresting a hill and seeing a view. It could be that feeling of getting rained on and it's sucking for a minute and then realizing that you're actually pretty comfortable and that we were built to suffer in minor ways. That there are so many ways you feel it. And even in a city, like in New York, in the summer, you go into Central Park and there are probably thousands of people just riding laps because they want that experience of like being around like grass and trees and feeling connected to the place. And so it is like that cross country trip where there are ways that you can like do something huge to be connected to nature. You know, I talked to Rebecca Rush in the book, and she's done like adventures in Southeast Asia and Alaska where, you know, totally unsupported, huge expeditions in nature. But you can get that in London or Los Angeles as well. And it's this beautiful thing that I think everybody can feel.
Do you have any favorite landscapes that you cycled in, or favorite rides, or, you know, what are the kind of places that really appeal to you?
For 11 years, I worked at the company that owned bicycling, which was based in a part of Pennsylvania about an hour north of Philadelphia. And there, it's a place where I would not choose to move back to for a bunch of reasons, but the riding around there was probably the best I've ever done in my life, where it was just this never-ending lattice of country roads, where if you went out on a Saturday or Sunday and rode north or west, you could just endlessly go on these beautiful, you know, with like covered bridges and cornfields and rolling hills, and it just never ended. So like the terrain was constantly shifting in subtle ways, and you could ride three up if you felt like it and talk to your friends. And yeah, that was beautiful. But I've been, you know, it's like, whatever, riding in the Dolomites is totally different, but really incredible. Also, you know, the hills of Malibu here are really different. And for where I live, to just get to the hills of Malibu is pretty harrowing. But there are just so many places that are incredible. Yeah, it's like, I think it's hard to pick just a couple, because it's like if you ride a lot, you see that, right? Like I've ridden in Flanders, and I think my body still hurts thinking about it. It's not beautiful in these conventional ways, and yet you're aware of just like the starkness, the way the light is in the early spring in Belgium, and just the smell of like mud is gorgeous in its own way. There's just so many different places you can access this.
And the fifth theme of the book, competition, which you have differentiated from speed. So explain what the difference is there and what your perspective is on that.
Yeah, I think this one was interesting because I think, you know, I love watching pro cycling. And so I think a lot of people who are your fans are also fans of racing. And there you're watching like the top 100th of 1% of bike athletes doing incredible things. And they're in it to like win and find glory and make a living. But for most of us, I think ultimately when you think about it, that like competition is this meaningfulness of testing yourself. And I think that part of the reason why like gravel racing has become popular and why Strava and Zwift have become a part of our culture so much is this feeling of like people wanting to test themselves and see what they're made of, and that's like deeper than actually like trying to win a race. And so I think that people who never have pinned on a number still feel that they know that like, oh, if they got a PR on some climb on Strava, that it means something, or that simply they felt some discomfort on a ride and pushed through it, or they went out with a few friends who were a little stronger with them and they held the wheel. There's just so many different ways that you get that feeling. And you mentioned running, like running is so comparatively unforgiving that like there's something about a bicycle that just like is built to help us. Like you can test yourself and feel like, oh, I'm so tired right now, and then somehow like 5 minutes later you're fine and you can do it again. And you can kind of do it all, if you put a moderate amount of time, you can kind of do it all day. It's like, you know what I mean, like you could do it day after day. And so it's this wonderful tool to test yourselves. I don't want to race anymore, I think. But I love testing myself all the time.
And that's it, isn't it? Because the World Tour pros are very good at what they do, and they get paid a lot of money to do it, or paid some amount of money to do it. You know, you and I entering our local chippers race to come 40th or 50th, we don't have those motivations, yet we still do it.
In the book, I have this anecdote of a cyclocross race that took place in Bill Strickland, who's also a cycling journalist, and he and his wife's house in Pennsylvania, and it was always at night, and it was like this range of people that was from like pro cyclocross racers and elite track riders to people like me or people worse than me. And it was this communion of just coming out and testing yourself in a kind of intentionally ludicrous set of circumstances was like probably the best racing I ever was a part of, because, you know, we just crave experience and community, and competition gives you that, like that feeling of like you just did something that felt pretty hard and you push through it, and you're like sitting around tired and somebody hands you a beer or whatever, and it can feel so meaningful. I think almost everyone who rides tries to bring some element of that into the experience.
Yeah. And you also explored a little bit cycling fandom, like us watching cycling as a sport. And really, maybe it's best not to examine cycling fandom too hard, because really it's an absurd sport to watch as a spectacle. There's long periods where nothing is happening, and you don't get the distilled action and exhilaration and highs and lows that you get in, say, a basketball match or a football match or most other sports. Yet at the same time, we know it's a really cool sport to watch.
Probably you're the same. I'm not the best person to ask, because I still like watching the first 5 hours of Milan-San Remo. So I find it all interesting on some level. Part of what I think people in bike culture love is they love that it's like a niche sport, like that it's something that not everybody understands clearly. But I do think that there's an element of when you watch the world's best riders that informs our own sense of bike culture. That I do think that the races take place in these like iconic places around the world, you know, mostly in Europe, but elsewhere, that are like the best places to ride. These are people that have just put so much they have talent, but they've also like committed so hard to it. And you know that how deep they're going. And so it like, you do feel like a connection to them, that like when I watch the NBA, even though I like played basketball poorly when I was young, I don't feel any connection to them. But when I watch them go up the Poggio, it's like, I know the experience of going up a hill where it's not that long, but it's really hard. And that feeling of like, can you help a friend or a teammate? Can you survive? Can you have a gap for them and try and catch people on the downhill? Those are all like really universal feelings that everyone who rides a lot has experienced. And so it connects you to the action.
And the final chapter of the book is called Self-Expression, which is an interesting one, because I didn't know quite what to expect about this chapter. So maybe you can sum it up better than I can.
Yeah, I mean, initially when I started writing it, that was two chapters that I ultimately decided to put together. And it's probably like the broadest idea in the book. And I kind of left it for last because of that, because like on one level, self-expression is just about like how personal style is part of riding, right? Like that, like what you wear and how you present yourself, you know, whether you want to have a hand-built bike or wear Rafa, this feeling that style and personal taste are intersecting with riding is this beautiful thing. Like there's more beauty in cycling that people are aware of than they were in the past. And then like on a deeper level, though, self-expression is just about tolerance and inclusion. Once you take that first step of being like, I'm just gonna like, you know, now I feel comfortable where like I feel comfortable that I'm wearing like a cotton t-shirt right now, and there might be like a gravel ride now where I feel like, oh, I can just show up in a cotton t-shirt if I feel like it. And it's not like there's a uniform to do this. And then on some way deeper level, it just means that like everyone who rides is just finding their own way and wants to be a part of this. And that once like people give me the okay to express how I want to be on a bike, that I like return that into the culture. And so whether it's women or Black people riding or trans people trying to find their space, whether it's about accepting beginners or people that just ride in a totally different way than you, that I sense this feeling in bike culture that's definitely not uniform, but happening, of just like this feeling of like accepting people as they are into the culture. And so it's like a pretty broad chapter where I'm saying like, you could wear a cool kit from Rafa and that self-expression and like feeling like someone whose life choices are totally different than yours is also part of bike culture. That's a lot to come together.
And it's a kind of conclusion to the book, isn't it? It's asking, what is a cyclist? And you mentioned it earlier on, and it's quoted in the book as well. The answer is, if you're riding a bike, you're doing it right.
Yeah, I mean, I feel so strongly about it, and it happens to me every day where, you know, I ride to work and I see like these folks that are disabled on recumbent bikes, or I see older people now here sometimes on like e-bikes that are trikes. I see people with mountain bikes on cars that are not riding, and they like drive to a trailhead, and just like this really beautiful, empowering feeling once you like accept that everyone who does this thing is like your brother and sister, right? Like when I rode home from the Hollywood Reporter, it was like tons of Hispanic restaurant workers are out riding around LA at 1 a.m. because that's how they like get to and from their job. And this idea that we're just like a part of a subculture of like people who ride road bikes and expensive spandex that can do 22 miles an hour, it's so limiting, right? This like that to actually feel like you're a part of something really big, this huge tent that everyone's welcome in, is just a beautiful thing. And I want more people to feel, I see more people feeling that, but I think it can, hopefully the book is like just a small piece to move the culture in that direction.
And did re-examining cycling for the book give you a better insight or a different insight into your own relationship with cycling?
It did. You know, actually, I initially wanted to call the book Why We Ride, but apparently somebody wrote a book about motorcycle culture with that name and the lawyers wouldn't allow it. And it really, like, the whole first year of ideation and reporting was like thinking about why I ride and thinking about all the components of it. And so, yeah, I think that kind of self-reflection, at least for me, is really good, because I've always known that I love to ride. Like if I have half a day on Sunday, there's honestly like nothing I'd rather do now than go out on my own and just like tootle around on a bike all day. And to just like think about like, why is that? Like, why do I love this? Why do I feel like it is part of who I am on some profound level? And yeah, it was really instructive for me to just try and think about and sketch out like an understanding of why I love it so much.
Yeah, and reading the book also made me re-examine my own relationship with cycling. It's gone through a lot of phases, all of which have been very meaningful. At the moment, I'm probably a utility cyclist more than anything, but I'm in cycling for the nature, sometimes for the speed, rarely for the competition these days. But it just shows how there is intersection between all these parts of your own experience of cycling and everyone else's.
Yeah, I mean, everyone I've talked to so far is the same, where I think at any given moment, maybe some of those ideas are more prominent in your riding life than others, but that everybody understands them all, which is really gratifying.
So, Peter's book, Live to Ride, Finding Joy and Meaning on a Bicycle, is available now. It's out this week, in fact, and it's an excellent read, which made me examine my own motivations and relationship with cycling. Please support independent bookshops if you can by ordering or buying it from them. Peter, thank you very much for joining us on Rouleau Conversations. I'm looking forward to the next book.
Thanks. It was really great talking with you.
You have been listening to Rouleau Conversations. Rouleau Conversations is made by the editorial staff of Rouleau Magazine. Follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Rouleau and on Instagram at Rouleau Magazine, or visit our website at rouleau.cc. This edition of Rouleau Conversations was produced by Joseph Perry of Content is Queen.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.